Okay, I think we can make a start. Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the LSE and welcome to the social policy subject talk. My name's Dr. Coretta Phillips and I'm an associate professor in the Department of Social Policy, which in old money is a reader. And I've been teaching at the LSE for about 13 years. I'm admissions tutor for our undergraduate programmes and I'm really pleased to be able to talk to you about the teaching and learning in our department, and I'm essentially going to follow the outline on this first slide, and I'm going to spend a bit of time talking about what we study in the discipline of social policy, because it's not a subject that is taught either in further education colleges or sixth forms. So some of you may not be fully aware of exactly what our discipline entails. And then I'm going to talk to you a bit about what I see as some of the strengths of the department, and also to try and draw your attention to the things that you might be looking at, given that you're making a substantial both financial and career intellectual commitment to study now at undergraduate level. So I'm hoping that I can entice you and excite you by the kinds of things that we do in the department. And I've spent some time talking about the programmes and the courses, but given that we have five undergraduate programmes and a large number of courses, much of which is covered online, I'm going to go through essentially just the main social policy programme, because we have five programmes in the department. Two of them are run entirely internally within the Department of Social Policy, which is one of the biggest departments at the school. But for those of you that might be interested in studying social policy with economics, with government, or with sociology, those parts of the programme are dealt with within those respective departments. And as I say, much of that information is online. I'm happy to answer any questions at any point in the talk or at the end if you have any. So please feel free to put your hand up, indicate if you have a question. It's intended to be an informal rather than a more formal session. I'll say something about the entry requirements, which are also, of course, detailed in the prospectus, give you a sense of how teaching and assessments carried out at the LSE and certainly in my department, and then just give you a flavour because, of course, given the commitment that you're making at undergraduate level now doing a BSc or a BA, you want to know where it might lead you in the future. And although there isn't a specific career path for our programmes, there are clearly a number of areas in which our graduates move into, and I want to just give you a flavour of those at the end of the talk. So first of all, what is social policy? It's a multidisciplinary subject. It draws mainly from principles, ideas, theories, concepts within these three disciplines that are in bold: economics, politics and sociology. So it's essentially concerned with asking questions about welfare, well-being, the organisation and delivery of services to promote welfare and well-being, and to address in a range of social problems. So in relation to these parent disciplines, questions of economics enter into questions and ideas in social policy, and essentially asking questions about how do we distribute resources in our society, how are they allocated, who gets what, put crudely. So that's one of the key elements of economics within social policy. In terms of politics, we're looking at the way in which our response to addressing social problems... Yes? I mean, we tend to find that there are some subjects which are more suitable to studying social policy than others. But given its diversity, given the fact that it isn't a subject that's taught at A-level, we're fairly flexible about the kinds of subjects. We find generally that students that come to the LSE and take our programmes do better if they've studied traditional academic subjects. And I'll come back to that a bit later on in the talk. So we're looking at who gets what, as I said, a very crude way of thinking about the distribution of resources in society. we look at the mechanisms and decision-making processes by which those decisions about allocations are made. So that's the kind of political science element of the discipline. And then sociology is more broadly concerned with questions of social stratification, social division, and social policy is very much concerned with broad cross-cutting issues in relation to different social groups in society. So probably in this room we have people who could be identified as from different genders, different ages, different generations, different ethnicities, possibly some who may experience some form of disabilities. All of those are different ways in which our society is stratified, and all of those may have an impact on the way in which we care for ourselves and others, and also in terms of how widely, how well, or how poorly important resources are distributed across society. These are the three main disciplines that we draw from, but psychology, demography, criminology, which is my primary discipline, development studies, gerontology, concerned with ageing, and history, all of these disciplines are represented within the department, and many of these will be represented in individual courses as well. So just to give you an indication of just how relevant our discipline is, last week that there was lots of discussion about the budget, of course, and for people like me, whose retirement isn't that far on the horizon, I'm very interested in discussions around pensions. Of course, that was a key element of the budget for this year. George Osborne talked about the budget as being a budget for the makers, doers, and savers. And you will have seen, perhaps, in lots of political rhetoric, a concern, particularly around the abuse of the welfare system and concerns around hard-working families. And the idea in the budget was that one of the rewards that government could provide or free up, if you like, is to provide a more flexible way in which people who have retired are able to access the resources that they've paid into their pension pots. There was also discussion about Help to Buy, and of course we are, if the newspapers are right, and certainly some economic views are, that we are heading towards another housing crisis, perhaps we're in a housing bubble. But currently there's been a recognition that young people, particularly in areas like London, have struggled to get onto the to get into the housing market. And so there's now Help to Buy, that was a scheme that was extended and referred to in last week's budget. This would provide money for people to go back to what we had around probably 10 years ago now, when people could borrow a large sum of money from the banks. There was also discussion around childcare costs, and that raises really interesting issues around whether the role of government should be supporting primarily, but not exclusively, women to join the labour market, or whether they should be supporting them as carers of young families and often increasingly elderly relatives. But there was a discussion about how we might make childcare costs slightly more manageable. And tax reductions for the low paid. We have a Conservative-dominated coalition government, and traditionally Conservative parties have been interested in reducing the levels of tax that individuals pay, seeing it as a disincentive for economic growth. So all of these things were relevant in the budget, and all of these issues are relevant and central to the discipline of social policy. And if you're not persuaded by that, if you just look, and there's a similar pie chart in the What is Social Policy leaflet that you have on the table, you can see from this chart the considerable amount of expenditure on areas of welfare. So social protection is the largest slice of the pie at $222 billion. Personal social services, $31 billion. Health, $140 billion. Education, $98 billion. Employment included within industry and agriculture at lower. Housing and environment, $25 billion. Public order and safety covering criminal justice, $32 billion. So a considerable amount of expenditure is centred on services and benefits which are centrally important to the discipline of social policy. So what exactly do we do? We address and consider social problems, and they are hugely diverse, everything from education, health, poverty, inequality, global poverty, if we're thinking internationally, housing, homelessness, fertility, family planning problems. This is an image of a child in China where still they are bearing the legacy of single child policies that varies across rural and urban areas. Issues around disability, employment, crime. All of these are relevant to social policy. And just to give you an indication of the kinds of questions that we're interested in, this is reflects the diversity and the breadth of the discipline. Everything from crime to looking at fertility and migration patterns in developing and transitional economies, looking at social exclusion, looking at disability, healthcare, issues around migration and immigration, education, social mobility, issues particularly which have been high on the agenda currently, certainly for the last 5 to 10 years, have been concerns around, again, the abuse of the immigration system, particularly in relation to either crime or what are seen as bogus asylum claims. Now, all of these are contested issues, and just to give you an indication of this, if we look down towards the bottom of this list, some of you may not be aware that when we look at global patterns of migration and immigration and take into account migration within countries, so if we were thinking about the UK, migration from, say, Scotland, which is still, of course, just part of the UK. But if we think about that within the context of migration down to London, or we might be looking at migration in somewhere like Pakistan from rural to urban, it's interesting that developing countries house most of the world's refugees, not surprisingly, given that many refugee crises are the result of ethnic conflict or various forms of civil war, but also famine. It's not surprising, perhaps, that most of the world's refugees are actually housed in developing countries. But the issue of asylum and immigration has been high on the political agenda here for a number of years. So all of these are areas that can be and are contested, and we look at these from a variety of different perspectives and draw on a range of theories and ideas to explore all of these kinds of issues. Social policy is also about thinking about how we respond to social problems and how we think about organising the delivery of services. So we might, for example, be interested in questions about the impact of aid to reduce health and education inequalities in developing countries, Tanzania, Kenya. We're interested in how we organise and finance what many would argue is one of the best national health systems in the world. We look at models of educational provision, particularly given the importance of education and credentialism in our post-industrial societies. We look at questions like how do we respond as a society outside of things like the Help to Buy scheme? How do we respond as a society to social groups who are unable to access resources required for a private mortgage? Currently, we are providing a residual housing, social housing provision. Are there other ways in which we could deliver housing for often many vulnerable groups in society? And we can look to the way in which housing, social housing is delivered in different but similar countries, perhaps in the Western European context, to understand how things might look differently in the UK. We also look at questions like what should be the appropriate delivery of policing services at a neighbourhood level to reduce crime? And we deal with a range of often surprising questions in the sense that many people have a perception that crime is increasing and that crime is a significant social problem in our society. But actually, we know from a number of different data sources, household surveys, police recorded crime figures, but also from data in accident and emergency departments, minor injuries units, that actually crime has been decreasing for 15 years. And interestingly, that's not something that's just happened in England and Wales. It's a trend that we see across most Western nations. So social policy is about considering some of the received wisdom about a whole range of areas. Another example would be just to counter some of the media discourse around welfare claimants. And of course, we have a range of programs like, actually, I won't name any names, but a number of programs which are highly entertaining, somewhat disturbing, in where we learn about the experiences of groups who are considered to be vulnerable, but also considered to be often acting in fraudulent ways, perhaps, and depriving us as taxpayers of our resources. The government's figures suggest, and the government does collect figures on welfare fraud, and some of this is about overpayments, so errors by civil servants, and some is about willful, often organised abuse of the welfare system. The government's own figures suggest that around 0.7% of what's spent on welfare is paid out erroneously, and that may be because of fraud or because of overpayment by staff. Now, you wouldn't have that sense either from media accounts, and that's both broadsheets and tabloid newspapers, nor if you listen to a number of politicians who, for a variety of reasons, some economic, some political, have real concerns about managing the welfare budget. And if we return to the pie chart, then there are really good reasons for thinking about how we contain welfare expenditure. But 0.7%, so less than 1%, the government estimates is being provided to claimants erroneously. So these are the kinds of questions that we're interested in looking at, how we organise the delivery of welfare, what are the pros and cons of means-tested benefits, how should the market respond to environmental pollution, what exactly is reassurance policing, and does it work? Does it simply reassure, or does it actually reduce crime? What impact does foreign aid have on the ultra-poor in developing countries? What are the rights and responsibilities of citizenship? What effect has unemployment protection had in very diverse and very different countries to ours? Are there things that we can learn from other nation states about the way in which they deliver and organise welfare? I have a couple of short clips that I'd like to show you, which also talk to the kinds of things that we're interested in social policy. The first is a 5-minute clip based on some research, but it does highlight again what we can learn, particularly if we think comparatively. And I'll come on and show you another one afterwards.
Now, how do we get the best of England and move that over to the US, and take the best of the US and bring it over to the UK? We looked across the pond, and the U.S. said, well, wait a second, England spends less, and they live longer. You know, how can this be? How is this possible? Well, both countries are very, very different. At one end of the spectrum, the U.S. has historically been much more private. On the other end, the NHS, typically quite state-run. And any more than we can take pub culture from, say, the U.K. and shift that over to the U.S., we can't take the NHS and just parachute that into the U.S. The question is, what can each country learn from each other? I think the UK needs much more patient choice. You know, historically, the NHS patients have had to be just that. They've had to be patient. They waited a long time. The system was all too frequently geared toward the convenience of the provider rather than the convenience of the patient. And I think what we're seeing in the US is much more consumer-directed healthcare that hopefully the UK begins to adopt. Well, historically, the NHS was really devoid of financial incentives. You know, budgets were set the year before. Hospitals essentially did what they thought was right with very, very little attention paid to what patients wanted. The service was structured much more to the convenience of the provider than to the patient. And what that meant is not too many incentives for quality, not too many incentives for efficiency. People wanted to do the right thing, but essentially they were working in a structure that really didn't have the incentives that you needed for a 21st century healthcare system. The idea with patient choice is you give patients a choice of where they can go, you give them the information to choose which is the best service, and hopefully then that creates real incentives for providers to step up their game, to provide a service for patients that's accessible when they want it, that's high quality, and that's really reactive to their needs. And the other issue that we talked a lot about was the potential of choice to promote equity. That traditionally in systems without choice, the people who have it tend to be the well-off, the educated, the wealthy. And it's the people who tend to be least advantaged in society who also don't have choice. So in systems without formalized choice, some people still have it. And that tends to be a source of inequality. And so what we said is, not only does this really create incentives to raise performance in the health service, to make a much more dynamic health system, it also probably has the potential to improve equity. And the really good news, we published an article in the BMJ which found just that. So that over the last decade, not only did waiting times fall significantly, but they became really much more equitable. So in 1997, the poorer you were, the longer you waited. You waited about 2 weeks more if you were in the most deprived quintile of the population. A decade later, there was almost no variation depending on who you were. And that's a huge success. One of the things you have in the U.S. is competition between insurance companies. And what you see in the U.K. is competition between hospitals. Interestingly, I'd say the U.S. is really suffering from a lack of competition right now. So if we look at Alabama, 90% of patients are insured by one company. If we look at Iowa, 74% of patients insured by the same company. And essentially what you have is private markets, low regulation, and no competition. And so we shouldn't be shocked that we see prices go up and quality go down. And that's just not simply a viable market. One of the things that President Obama is proposing is making the insurance market vastly more competitive. You know, so bringing in this public option that really will compete with the insurance companies that are there already. And that's very, very different than what you have in the UK, which is really regulated competition, which is public and private hospitals competing for public patients. Every country, US, the UK, are under pressure to do more with less. And historically what you see is in the US, they're much better at the acute high-end services, the cancer care, the stroke care. They don't do as well in the primary care. And the question is why? We looked across the pond and the US said, well, wait a second, England spends less and they live longer. You know, how can this be? How is this possible? They have worse cancer outcomes, they die more frequently from heart attacks, but somehow we don't live as long and we spend about twice as much. And part of the answer is really public health, and it's the health of the underlying population. And the lesson is, unless we get people healthier before they get to the hospital, we really aren't going to fundamentally change how much we spend on healthcare. I think that raises the issue of, well, how do you do that? You know, is it the government's responsibility? Is it the insurance company's responsibility? Is it our own responsibility for our health? And I think for me, the answer is it's probably a bit of all three. That it's the government creating an environment that allows a market with really fundamentally sound incentives to operate. It's insurance companies that make more money by providing better care rather than denying it. And it's still keeping in incentives for individuals to lead healthier lives so that they're rewarded for really fundamentally improving their own health status. But I think it raises a tricky question, you know, a delicate balance between autonomy and what's in the public good. And I think that's going to be one of the issues in the next 10, 20, 30 years. You know, to what extent are we willing to, you know, fundamentally limit people's choices, people's autonomy, what they can and can't do for the sake of public health?
So one of the questions is, should the NHS treat individuals who choose not to give up smoking, despite the fact that there may be a range of associated health problems? Should it be the role of government to step in and argue and limit individual autonomy, as my colleague suggested, or should the state be more willing to fund the healthcare of our increasingly large and obese population, a population who certainly affected significantly by excessive alcohol use amongst certain social groups, and not all of those are the obvious ones, I hasten to add, in case anyone's feeling persecuted. But, you know, these are really interesting but also very difficult political questions about what the role of the state should be in terms of educating the population and at the same time promoting and providing well-being and welfare. So these are really challenging and difficult issues. One of the things that you'll hear a lot of, if you haven't already here today, is the importance of research-led teaching. And I think it is fair to say that one of the things that LSE, one of the strengths of the LSE is that we have very active research interests, and that can inform and enhance our teaching. And just to give you three very brief examples, social policy, just like any other discipline, is concerned with concepts and theories, typologies, comparative frameworks, all of those ways of understanding and thinking about a variety of ideas. But the attraction, certainly for me, of social policy is that it also has a practical relevance. So my colleague, Professor Eileen Munro, was involved in a huge review of child protection, looking at child protection governance, trying to move away from what's increasingly recognised as a blame culture when we hear about the horrific circumstances in which a young person has been harmed, abused, murdered by their parents. And so whilst also talking around issues about child protection within her teaching, Professor Munro is also externally focused, interested in her research informing policy. By the same token, Professor Tim Newburn is currently employed in an official history of the criminal justice system that was ordered by Tony Blair when he was Prime Minister. But he's been even more recently involved in a study, a joint, very unusual study involving the Guardian newspaper and adopting a very similar approach to the studies that had been carried out in the US in the 1960s, where there had been a series of riots across urban America. And it involved the collaboration of a journalist and an academic in talking to, and in what was interesting about the Newburn study was it was talking to rioters who hadn't been arrested, hadn't been detected for the offences that they were involved in, and talking to them about their experiences of the riots. And just a very quick clip, 3-minute clip, on some of the findings.
Good evening and welcome to the programme. Frustration and anger towards the police was a major contributing factor to this summer's riots. That's according to the latest research into the Troubles. While previous reports have looked at the impact on the victims, academics from the London School of Economics spoke to hundreds of perpetrators to find out what caused the violent clashes and widespread looting. Porrick O'Brien reports.
During the riots, we saw their faces on our televisions, images that shocked us all.
It felt like Christmas had come early, just being able to take all the nice things that you want.
In today's report, we hear their voices, and in many ways, it's far more shocking.
They were within 10, 20 feet from officers, vandalising their vehicles, throwing bricks and everything, and the police had, they weren't doing nothing, there was no authority shown. It looked like, you know, we could have sort of run on the streets.
I just wanted to be there. Like, I actually wanted to burn the cars and just see it burn as well. Like, that was the best 3 days of my life.
The Guardian and the London School of Economics interviewed 270 people involved in the rioting. It's a complicated piece of research with a complicated set of answers to the question, why did you do it?
In terms of a coherent narrative, well, I think there is something, and that is that, you know, I think, is to do with the marginalisation of specifically some young people in our modern urban communities who feel themselves cut off from the mainstream and who feel that opportunities such as they are in modern Britain are not open to them.
Another theme among those interviewed is resentment of the police.
When we came across a police car, I felt like we hit the jackpot. We smashed it, we petrified it. We thought we'd just kind of violate, just like they violate us. They arrest people for no reason, they stop and check us for no reason. We thought kind of just get, like I said, get our own back. And that's what we did. We enjoyed it. I felt no guilt, nothing.
We asked the Deputy Mayor for Policing what he thought of these findings.
Well, look, all research is useful, but I would counsel two things. First of all, if you give a criminal an opportunity to blame somebody else for their crime, they'll normally take it. And secondly, we know that a very high proportion of these people had a criminal record, so it might not be a huge surprise that they have a bit of a grievance against the police.
Another headline of the report is that postcode gang rivalries seem to disappear. Everyone came together and became one big gang.
You had different areas that had gang-related problems working together. Everyone put their problems away for that week and was able to get along because we had one thing in common, and that was to hurt the government and the police.
No, it wasn't really gang-related. I think on those few nights of the riots, everybody united. I think we all had the same feeling. We all had this common feeling and we expressed it.
The government's independent riots panel report was published recently. This research is all very well and good, of course, but at some point the government will be asking itself, do we have a coherent policy response to the riots? If we do, what is it? If we don't, why not? Porrick O'Brien, BBC London.
So one of the things that's really interesting in relation to criminal justice responses to things like the riots is we might think in terms of... And Theresa May subsequently indicated that there will be a review of stop and search. But if we look at the range of responses that we can impose as a society on rioters and other offenders, then it's also important for us to know which are the most effective. And one of the things that's very clear is having more severe sentences have been shown to have almost no effect in terms of reducing crime. So if there is a sentiment, a public sentiment, and certainly there was after we saw these very shocking images in our TV screens, one response is to think, well, actually, these people should be locked up, they should be... And I think David Cameron was quoted as saying we should, talking to judges and magistrates, throw the rule book at the rioters. This was sheer criminality, brute criminality. In actual fact, that's one response, and it would cost about £28,000 a year, ongoing running costs, to house somebody in prison. It's unlikely to have very much impact either on their future offending behaviour or necessarily deter you or I or any others from committing crime. So again, when I'm talking about what we're interested in terms of contested areas within policy, one, what would be really very commonsensical idea, that we actually need much more severe sentencing policies in this country to deter offenders, has actually been shown across a number of different jurisdictions, across a number of years, to have very limited effect in terms of reducing crime. And just very quickly, my colleague Professor John Hills was involved in the National Equality Panel under the last government and has also been involved in developing definitions and also targets for reducing fuel poverty. And given the focus on what some would see as the abuses of the utilities companies, that's a really very real issue for particularly vulnerable groups in society. Now, the colleagues that I mentioned are all professors in the department. This SA100 is the core course for all of the social policy programmes that anyone starting at the LSE would take. And it's recognised that students are, of course, very interested in being taught by the most senior people across the school. And we endeavour to meet those expectations. And as you can see, for all of the courses, for all of the lectures for this first year, core course involves professorial staff. So these are the five programmes that we have. As I said before, the first two are run entirely within the department, and the other three, students take social policy courses within our department and then take a variety of courses in the parent departments, economics, government and sociology. The idea of each of the programmes is an intellectual development over the 3 years of your programme. So the first year courses... everything essay one dot 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 are courses for first years, and they are essentially gently introducing you to a variety of concepts and recognising that there can sometimes be quite a difficult transition between A-level study and the first years of a BSc. We then move into the second year to focus much more on concepts and principles. And then in the third year, certainly in the social policy programme, we're looking then at comparative frameworks and looking at the global international context. So just to give you another example in relation to criminology, we look at the concepts and broadly look across the criminal justice system from crime prevention, policing, community punishment, imprisonment. We then in the second year go into looking at how the discipline developed from the 18th century right now to what are the kind of emerging theoretical ideas within the discipline of criminology, particularly in England and Europe, but also in the US. And then in the third year, we move on to looking at crime control, looking at the application of broad concepts around due process, prevention, surveillance, looking at policing more broadly written, not just public, but also private policing, punishment, drugs, youth justice. So that idea of a progression across the 3 years is something that's applied across all of the programmes. Now, I'm not going to talk about the courses in any detail, except really to reiterate that the first year courses are introductory and they are nonetheless challenging, particularly for those of you who haven't studied any social policy before. There are certain elements, for example, within political science, within sociology and economics that would be entirely familiar. So it's a general, gradual introduction to disciplinary knowledge in our field. So the foundations course is interested in looking at the development of the welfare state. It's interested in introduces core concepts like citizenship. It also explores the changing boundaries of the role of the market, the state, the family, and the third sector in providing welfare. Sociology and social policy is looking at classic ideas within sociology, the development of social systems, the emergence of industrial, post-industrial economies, looking at concepts like post-Fordism, risk, globalisation, surveillance, social control. It's looking at questions of welfare and well-being through a sociological lens. And the same is true of social economics and policy. It's exploring patterns of poverty and inequality, looking at income maintenance, and looking at those through an economic lens. Population, economy and society, apologies, that was renamed this year, Introduction to Global Population Change. And that's essentially interested in looking at fertility, migration and mortality, both historically in the UK context, but also comparatively, particularly looking at the diversity of experience in developing and transitional economies. And that course looks at the impact of famine, the impact of war, impact of on disease, on populations, is interested in looking at the spread of HIV and AIDS and also the response to that, and more generally looking at family planning policies and reproductive health, both in developed and developing nations. And then the crime and society course is essentially an introduction to criminology course. Looks at how we measure crime, how it's understood and perceived by politicians, by the media, by us as members of the public. And then it looks at the distribution of crime across different groups, gender, ethnic groups, different age groups, and then looks at the key elements of the criminal justice system. In the second year, the core course Principles of Social Policy is a course which looks at theories of social need and looks at how we apply those to different social problems. And the research methods course is a challenging one. It introduces students to research design. It looks at measurement and analysis, both in qualitative methods and quantitative methods. And there's a computer workshop element of it where you'd be introduced to fairly basic descriptive statistics, but also the next level of looking at regression. And then the other courses that you take in your second year are options that you can take from across the school or within the department. In the third year, comparative and international social policy is the core course, so all students on the programmes take this course, and it's a course which essentially looks at global pressures on national policy environments. And so for this course, you would also look at the role of both international and supranational institutions on national policies. And then there's an opportunity for people to take a dissertation in the third year. And I just wanted to give you a flavour of what people have been interested in looking at in recent years. So one dissertation looked at, I'm not sure this was whether this was a personal interest, but looked at the impact of the most recent licensing regulations on drinking behaviour in England and Wales. There have been dissertations looking at forced migration. We've had dissertations looking at the impact of changes in access to secondary education and what impact that's had on different social groups in society. So this is where you would work with a supervisor, a member of staff, who would help you develop a research question and help you in the design of actually trying to address that research question. And again, there are optional courses that are available. And all of these courses are listed. Some of them I've talked about already, but you get a sense, again, of the breadth of what's covered in the department. And you also have options to take courses outside the department. The LSE is very traditional in the way it delivers, if you like, delivers teaching. So for each of the four courses that you take each year, you would have, across the two main teaching terms, an hour lecture a week, which is very much like the session today. And then you have an associated class, which means that in between the lecture and the class, you will have had a number of readings that would have been identified, journal articles, book chapters, occasionally books, in which you're expected to read and prepare and respond to a range of discussion questions for the class, which is usually the week after. These are compulsory. These are facilitated by the lecturer, but they essentially rely on maximum participation. So these are smaller groups, usually no more than 15, in which there will be some, often group work, discussions, presentations, sometimes some key tasks, looking at case studies or applying some of the conceptual and theoretical ideas that have been talked about in the lecture. And there are just a couple of examples there. Part of the traditional approaches means that the LSE is still very much wedded to formal examinations at the end of each academic year. So you will typically do somewhere in the region of 1 to 2 essays per term per course. So that could be between 4 and 8. And you will be examined at the end of the academic year. And it's typically a 3-hour exam with 4 questions that you're required to answer. Some courses have a small summative assessment, which is essay-based. So it might be 25% essay, an assessed essay, 75% exam, sometimes 2 hours, sometimes 3 hours. And then the dissertation. So in your third year, you may only have 3 exams. So our offer requirements are 2 A's and a B, if you're interested in social policy and economics. Because of the demanding nature of the economics courses that you take, we insist on an A in A-level math. And at GCSE level, for all of the programmes, you need a grade B at maths or above. There are other qualifications that are considered. So please don't be put off applying if you've come in a non-traditional route. So what am I looking for in an application? Nothing particularly fancy, if you like. I'm essentially looking for the personal statement to communicate to me that you have a passion for the subject area. And that can be fairly easy to demonstrate if it's genuine. So essentially, you need to demonstrate that you have some knowledge of our discipline. And I can appreciate that can be quite difficult to put into a personal statement if you're applying for very different programs. But you need to somehow craft a statement which recognizes and talks to the programs that we offer. So knowledge of what social policy is, a passion for understanding social issues, social problems, and how we can respond to them. Now, we don't say that you have to have a set number of extracurricular activities or interests in order to get to be offered a place, because sometimes that may well be difficult for some people. You know, perhaps if you have other kinds of commitments, financial or otherwise. But if there are ways in which you can demonstrate volunteering for a food bank or in being involved in various projects at school, or you can make references to things that you've read that you've found inspiring, then all of those things will count. You shouldn't feel that if you don't have any extracurricular activities or volunteering that you wouldn't be offered a place. That's not the way we approach the admissions process, certainly in this department. So despite the fact that we have a large number of applications for a relatively small number of places, I would really encourage all of you, if you have been interested in the things that I've talked about today, to submit an application. And then what do our graduates do afterwards? Well, I'm sure you'd be really relieved to know that most are in employment, further study, or taking time out 6 months after graduation. The LSE does well as in terms of ensuring that people move into what are considered, you know, appropriate destinations, either study or employment. And the average salary for the most recent figures that we've have is around 28,000 for undergraduates. So these are the kinds of jobs that our recent graduates have done. Moved into journalism, administration, but within the criminal justice services, a variety of communications, marketing and other administrative roles for NGOs or third sector organisations, working as a caseworker for an MP, going into graduate schemes within the civil service. Some people go on, a small number of people go on to do a master's either here or another institution, and some of those then go on to do a PhD. Some people are very keen to continue in research, and they might go into a policy organisation in an administrative or research role, be involved in policy analysis, for example, again in a government department or at local government level. Some people are interested, particularly internationally, in campaign and pressure group or other roles within NGOs. And some people go into social and welfare services, perhaps become a social worker, work in a housing association, become a police officer, etc. So are there any questions? Apologies, I know I've gone slightly over time. Lecturers can really waffle. Apologies.
I wanted to take language. Mm-hmm. So would it be possible to take language alongside the course?
Yes. Yep. So I have a student at the moment who's doing her dissertation and she's studying Spanish. Okay. So, yeah, absolutely. We have a language centre.
Would it also then be alongside they can do economics and social policy?
It would either be an optional course or you could choose to not do it as a registered course but as another, you know, an extracurricular activity. But there is room for you to do a course within the programme.
Would you still be hours?
Well, that's a good question, and it varies depending on what level you're at. So you'd need to look at, and you'd be assessed on the basis of your previous knowledge, experience, qualifications, or whatever. Okay. Yes.
You
Do you mean the only person from your programme on that option? Well, not if it's within the social policy department. That's unlikely, very unlikely. But, you know, the department's huge. So if you picked a subject and you were allowed onto the course, there weren't any prerequisites, and you picked a, you know, a law course or an anthropology course, it's more than possible then that there wouldn't be anyone else from your programme on it. Yes. Go ahead.
Does the mere social policy BS offer the basis for political thought and theory, or is that something that you would cultivate in your option?
Well, politics is very much part of social policy. It wouldn't be mainstream political philosophy as such. That is something that you probably need to explore through an optional course. But if you were doing social policy with government, of course, then that would be integrated into your programme. So it would slightly depend. I mean, the focus, you may be looking at social problems through these different disciplinary lens, but ultimately, of course, your interest is in relation to social policy. So it would depend on which programme, and there would be an option. There's an influence of political science, but if you're looking for political philosophy, then that probably would need to you would probably need to develop that within one of the optional courses. They can. There are certain restrictions. So if you wanted to take a course within economics, but you didn't essentially have the prerequisites, you wouldn't be allowed to take that course. But most courses are open. We don't have any prerequisites on our course. On our courses, so that means students from outside the department can take our courses. So it depends.
Hi, I've looked on the LSE website, and under the subjects, they display the number of students which are required for the course. So there's clearly a high demand for social policy courses. I'm most interested in social policy and economics, and there were some 174 people that applied for it in 2012. And they only let in four. So I'm kind of wondering, is that massive demand for this subject area, are the number of people that succeed in applications, is that going to change at all, or is that going to stay quite standard?
It's not changed hugely over the last few years. But it's worth recognising that some people do essentially put in speculative applications, that they have another programme in mind, or another institution. Sometimes people make decisions they don't want to study in London because it's, of course, as we all know, ridiculously expensive. Some people have a preference for living at home and studying near where they live. But generally, it varies, and it does fluctuate from year to year, but somewhere in the region of between 5 and 20% of applicants actually register or offered a place and register for the programmes. But that's probably the most popular course that people apply for. So I think it's unlikely that that would change very dramatically. We don't do that within the context of our programmes, no.
And also you talked about the situation with Tanzania different places, about the poverty and things like that. Do you offer, for example, courses where you can go to actually see the places and work there to see it?
No, I mean, the LSE provides a pretty traditional academic education, and we would support, we have good contacts and networks for people that are committed to trying to do things outside of the degree, but we don't have anything formally organised. Are there any other questions? Okay, yes. I'm sorry. Yes, there's a pile somewhere. Okay, well, good luck, everyone, and enjoy the rest of your visit. Okay.